Welcome to the Department of Sociology public event, the LSE, and thank you very much for turning up with weather raging outside. We're very grateful and hope that you all get home safely. We're here to celebrate the launch of a new book called The Sociology of Speed, Digital, Organizational and Social Temporalities, which has been edited by Judy Weissman and me. And is published right now by Oxford University Press. There are some copies outside for you to buy. There are also some vouchers, so you can get a 30% discount online. So you may prefer to do that, and you won't have to carry the book home in the snow. The book began life a couple of years ago at a workshop held here at the LSE in May 2015, where all the chapters were presented and discussed. We're delighted that the book has been published just 18 months after that workshop was held. And we're grateful both to our authors and to OUP for working so quickly. You might well say that this is appropriate for a book all about speed. But as you will see when you read the book, there is not a clear consensus that we do, in fact, now live in a society characterized predominantly by speed up. Like time, the pace of life is a collective, socially rich accomplishment and is practiced and experienced differently by diverse groups. And this brings me to the title of tonight's lecture, Do We Really Live in an Acceleration Society? Our speaker is Hartmut Rosa, who is one of the contributors to the book. Hartmut is a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Vienna. Having previously worked and studied at a variety of prestigious institutions, including Humboldt, Harvard, and the New School. He even spent two terms as a student at the LSE, aged 23. So just a couple of years ago. Hartmut is a highly distinguished figure who usually features at or very near the top of most people's list of key German thinkers today. He's the author of a number of books, including Social Acceleration, 2005, High Speed Society, 2008, World Relations in the Age of Acceleration, 2012, Acceleration and Alienation, 2013, Sociology, Capitalism, Critique, 2015, and most recently, Resonance, A Sociology of Self-World Relations, 2016. His work focuses on the double-edged nature of social acceleration in contemporary societies. As he argues in this chapter in this book, the increasing flexibility of time sovereignty and time sovereignty that technology affords to us does not reduce but increases our sense of being squeezed by time. In Acceleration and Alienation, he argues that many of us have become enslaved to the ideal of living life to the fullest. This is profoundly alienating, not least because it leads us to experience a hunger for new things that will never be satisfied. No matter how fast we become, he writes, the proportion of the experiences we have will continuously shrink in the face of those we have missed. Hartmut will speak for around 50 minutes this evening, followed by Judy, who will say a few things about the book. After this, we'll be taking questions from the audience, and we hope you'll join us for a reception at the end. So now, please give a warm welcome to Hartmut Rosa.
Thank you very much, Nigel, for this very kind introduction, and thanks to you and Judy Weitzman for the invitation to come here. As Nigel Dodd has already said, I mean, as a speaker, you always say, I'm very happy to be here, and I always love London, and I have high esteem for the LSE and so on. But today, it's really different from me for the reason you just gave, because I sat in this very theater as I was still an undergraduate student at that time, because in Germany I had to do 2 years of spare military service. It was civic service, right? So I was an undergraduate at that time, and I wasn't even a sociology student. I was studying German literature and philosophy and political science, and I came to the LSE, and that really changed my life, I dare to say, because it was here that I first encountered Charles Taylor's writing, and then I later on did my dissertation on Taylor, and I took my first sociology courses, and a lot of things really started for me in academically as well as personally, so it really feels very special. So thanks a lot for the opportunity to come back to this place. Yes, I want to talk about, for many years I actually thought and worked, as you just heard from Nigel's kind introduction, I thought about this problem of speed and this logic of speed, and I had the idea. Actually, at the LSE, I learned about Charles Taylor, and when I was done with Taylor, I was still thinking about, Taylor somehow suggests that we live our lives according to or guided by our strong evaluations. We have a kind of moral map which says what is important and what's not so important, what's good, what is bad, and that kind of guides our lives. And I thought after my book on Taylor, well, maybe that's not completely right. When I look at how people live, I see that very often they don't do the most valued thing, the most important thing first, but the most pressing thing, right? So temporality is apparently a crucial factor if we think about how we live. And that's how I started to think about social acceleration, and maybe you recognize this. It's actually a Motorhead cover or Gasmatron, and I use it to illustrate the idea that modernity is somehow driven. It's not just that acceleration is something that happens to us, right? Setting the world in motion, dynamizing it, becoming fast and flexible, right, and having the capacity to change and remake and reinvent things. Is somehow, it's in our cultural fabric and in our structural fabric too. And I will try to point out tonight how I think this is. But actually when you think about and when you read about how people think and talk about speed, very often it's through the negative side, through worries that the world becomes too fast and we become the victims, like this poor frog here, who is run down by a society which is... I mean, there are many, many metaphors, and they are not only metaphors in the 21st century. You find them all along since the 18th century, right? That the world is running away, runaway world, as Anthony Giddens, for example, wrote a book. But Paul Virilio says, well, in modernity, right, the world comes down on us like an accident, right? We feel kind of run over by a world. So, of course, the problem is that if we are not fast enough, if you don't get your degrees and essays and whatever it is fast enough, you will suffer the fate of the frog. It was actually a commercial, an advertisement by a internet connection. By a mobile technology. It said, if you are not fast enough, get a faster device, basically. All right. So, and then, of course, I was very grateful that Judy and Nigel came up with this idea of doing it really seriously, coming up with the idea of, saying that maybe it's about time to do something like a sociology of speed. There's this one book Nigel also mentioned, High Speed Society, which I edited with Bill Scheuermann some time ago. It's a collection of writings which is mainly by past writers. So here, with your idea was to do it really contemporary sociology focused on speed, and I think that's a terrific idea, and I'm very glad that this book is out now, and I hope it will inspire students and colleagues alike. So I want to move in three steps, basically. But the first step is the most important one, and it will also take the most time, most of the time. What actually is acceleration? Because you have to do it very systematically. I mean, on an anecdotal level, people would kind of agree, yes, we live in an acceleration society, we're running out of time, or things have become so fast. But one has to be really careful, you know, proclaiming every time new societies, risk society and the society of labor and the society of experience and whatever there is, right? So I really want to, what I want to do tonight and discuss with you is trying to make it as systematic and clear-cut as possible to define why or in what sense can we talk of modern society as a acceleration society. And then in the second step, which will be only shorter, I want to kind of rethink the reasons for this logic of setting the world in motion. My claim really is modernization. A modern society can only be understood as a society which increasingly sets the world in motion. But what is the driving factor? Why is it? Particularly, why is it, even though on a cultural level, there has always been skepticism, right? I mean, when you look at how people think and reflect on speed. Very often it's very pessimistic. I mean, when the railways were introduced, people thought, oh, that's too fast, that's unhuman, right? It's killing us, right? It's actually too much for our brains. They had serious evidence, medical and other, that human brains cannot master more than about 30 kilometers per hour or so. And this kind of story comes with every new technology, right? Then they thought that certainly the car will kill us or TV will kill us. And now there's a lot of skepticism that probably the cell phone will kill us, right? It's always the same, by the way, the idea that it will kind of somehow melt our brains, which we actually have now with the cell phone. So why is it still going on? What is driving this logic? And then in the last step, you know, my own tradition now is very much in critical theory tradition, the Frankfurt School, Adorno, Habermas, and so on. So I really also want to keep up the critical bite. What is possibly wrong, or where are problems with this logic of acceleration? So that's the three steps. So let's go. Let's dig right into it. So modernity is about the acceleration of time, as a quote by Peter Conrad, right? He's written this huge cultural history of modernity, and he makes that claim, which I quite liked as a starting point, even though I don't find it very helpful, because of course it's not time that is accelerating, right? It's very hard. You would have to use a very subjective, maybe a Bergsonian conception of time, and then you can say, well, time is somehow accelerating, but I think it's probably processes in time which are accelerating. Nevertheless, it's interesting once you look for it that in the cultural diagnosis of modernity, in the self-observation, particularly in the in the world of literature, for example, and the arts, you really find a high awareness that something is changing in the temporal structures, and this seems to be, to me at least, a very specific modern notion, right? I would claim it really takes off in the 18th century. But Shakespeare, he's a kind of seismograph of changes in the world. He comes a bit earlier in Hamlet, in the final act of the no, in the final scene of the first act. Hamlet states the time is out of joint, right? and this is very peculiar, because it's not the idea that something is wrong with society or the age. People always thought that. But Shakespeare starts saying, well, no, it's temporality itself which seems to be somehow distorted or which seems to have become problematic. And this, I don't want to go through the whole list. Somehow it doesn't work as it should. Well, I can also press the key. Time is out of joint. Yes, and then, for example, Jean-Jacques Rousseau writes about very, very. I mean, that's in the late 18th century. No, it's even in the middle 18th century, right? Rousseau writes about the tourbillon social. His observation is that somehow the world is changing into a whirlwind, right? And he says, you don't know the next day what. No, you don't know today what you might like the next day. This almost sounds like a postmodern subjectivity, right? Which changes its preferences and inclinations. Very quickly. And Baudelaire defines modernity actually as the fleeting, the transient, the transitory, right? The modern is the thing that does not stay, that changes at a very high rate. So with this, I only want to point out that the sense of a change in temporal structures is culturally very widespread. As a German coming from Jena in particular, it's right next to Weimar, we have to quote Goethe. And Johann Wolfgang Goethe actually writes in a letter, he has many references to temporality. In one, he says his age has become a velociferous. It's the age of velociferosity. It's velocitas, speed, and Lucifer, the devil. Right? He thinks they somehow joined together. Right? And he says that our temporality, we live in an age, our age, which is marked by the fact that we don't let things. We don't give things enough time, right? We always want to reap before the harvest has come, so to speak. And Nietzsche says he thinks our age will in the end up in a new barbarian age because of the haste, because of the same. And this goes all the way through from about 1800 or about 1750 to our age. In 2000, James Gleick wrote a book, which I like the title, because it's the acceleration of just about everything, right? Faster, the acceleration of just about everything. So he observes speed, changes in the temporality of love life, of work life, of speech itself. They're interesting, actually, analysis, investigations, empirical research in how fast do people walk, how fast do people talk, right? How fast do people try to act. And you really see a kind of consistent pattern of speed up with whatever we call processes of acceleration. But of course, it's wrong to say that it's an acceleration of just about everything, right? So I think what we need, that's why we have this book, Sociology of Speed, what is really speeding up and what's not speeding up? Because it's not good sociology if you only look for things that speed up and then you say, well, that's proof, right? That's proof of nothing, because you always find things that speed up and you find things that do not speed up. So I want to do this very systematically, and I have the next slide. I was actually thinking about whether I want to give you this or not, because it takes time and I need to be fast. But I think my claim is I don't want to develop this too much here, but I really believe that sociology as a discipline is a very modern thing too, right? It's not thinking about society is not very modern. They have done it since the age of the Greeks, and they have done it even before, of course. But sociology as a discipline, I think it really starts, I always say to my students in Germany, it starts as a reaction to processes of modernization, but I think I can make it more specific. It's the experience that society seems to be set in motion, that there is a change in the stability, in the mode of stabilization of society. I will come back to this in the end. Nevertheless, I think social theory basically takes four perspectives on society, right? You can either look to the structure, how is this thing called society? We know it's difficult enough to say what the thing called society might be. But if we have a thing like society, we can look at how it's structured. And then the process of modernization seems to be a process of differentiation, right? Like Durkheim would say, in contemporary sociology, Niklas Luhmann in particular, functional differentiation, the differentiation of the spheres of value, Weber would say. But if you look at it from a more cultural perspective, then with Max Weber and then later on, for example, with Habermas, you could say, no, it's a process of rationalization, right? That's not too easy to define either, but we can do this. Or we can look at the personality types, how the interaction between individual and society changes, and then the process of modernization appears to be a process of individualization, like Simmel, for example, stressed very much, but then Beck or Schulze, Ulrich Beck certainly had a sense of this when he came up with this idea that there's a second wave of individualization. Or we can look at the way, at nature, so to speak, at our interaction with nature, at the way how we reproduce materially, so to speak. And then with Marx or with Adorno, the main process is the process of domestication of nature or of instrumental reason. Of course, you know, I've also always given you a paradox here, because it's too easy to look at society just through these lenses. But it's just a suggestion as how we have thought about processes of modernization. Right? One way to categorize this is we have interpreted it as differentiation, rationalization, individualization, and also domestication. And now my claim in my social acceleration book, which is also out in English in Columbia University Press 2013, Social Acceleration, A New Theory of Modernity, the claim is that these processes are really interlinked. Maybe what is their common element is a change in the way we temporarily relate to the world, or we restructure the world. And the idea is that modernization is the process of setting the world in motion, of dynamizing it. And this is what I now want to prove. So I claim sociology is a reaction to this. And actually, it's quite interesting. Once you start rethinking it, then you find that that the classics actually had a very strong sense of this, actually of speeding up. When you read Max Weber, right, who identified the Protestant ethics as a new feature of modernity, a new ethos. And when you read the Protestant ethics, you find that he quotes Baxter, for example, that wasting time becomes the deadliest of all sins. Rationalization is about not wasting time using it, right, for yourself and for others. So I think when one reads Weber's Protestant ethics, one gets a very strong sense of how the way we temporally relate to the way the world changes. And when you read Simmel, for example, whom we would use at least in German sociology as one of the founding fathers, then you also see that he uses the metropolitan life, London, for example, or Berlin, as the chiffre, so to speak, as the paradigm for modern society. And he says, and what is the most important distinct difference between metropolitan life and rural life, which is the pre-modern life? Well, it's the speed of life. He actually writes on this and this says it's the speed of nervous life, the number of certainly Nigel Dodd knows a lot about that and has written on it. It's the number of stimulations we receive, right, and reactions we are forced to make is highly increasing in modern metropolitan life. And that in the end leads to a change in the way we think about the world, we feel about the world, we interact with the world, and so on. And when you read Marx and Engels, just read the Communist Manifesto for one time, right? I mean, very often it's read as a document of class struggle, which it is, but it's also an incredible document of acceleration, right? He really says what capitalism does. I mean, the capital makes the bourgeoisie kind of race across the world, and it's forced to permanently make new the ways of production, the means of productions, and the ways and means of circulation and consumption. Right. So it really is it's an account of speeding up the world, and in the end, you know, they arrive at their famous dictum: all that is solid melts into air, which Marshall Berman then takes as his book. Mm-hmm. For identifying what modernity is about. And even in Durkheim, it's not so easy in Durkheim, but when you read Durkheim, you see that his main fear was that we lose solidarity and we have a problem with the normative regulation of life. So anomia is the great problem. And what causes anomia? Well, the speed of change, if it's too high for solidarity and for morality to redevelop, right? So my claim is that in the classics of sociology, you really see they react to the sense of a world speeding up. But then this dimension gets lost until you come along and invent the sociology of speed, right? So when you read Habermas or so, Then I think this sense is no longer strong. I mean, it's there in Giddens, certainly. He's kind of rediscovers temporality and also Luhmann, but I don't really think they do it in a very consistent way. I mean, it's just that they feel, that's my take on them, they feel we should do something there, but they haven't really done it yet. So if you follow along so far and you agree that we should pay attention to how the world changes temporally, and that it has something to do with speeding up, then of course the question is, what is really speeding up? This claim, when I started working on it, I couldn't believe it, that you do find many references to speed, but it's a total mess. Some say time is speeding up. Actually, to this day, I don't know what that means. And some say life is speeding up, or society is speeding up, or culture is speeding up, or history is speeding up. It's without any systematics. So what is the systematics here? It is. Mm-hmm. I think we have to distinguish three dimensions. And I really want to, you know, I mean, when I started working on it, a lot of people said, and even colleagues said, or at that time, well, I did my habilitation on this, right? They said, well, acceleration is just a way of perceiving things. It's a perceptual thing, and it's a rhetorical thing, right? But it's not so much a real thing, because you have processes which speed up, and you also have processes which slow down. So I really want to turn this into a kind of empirical research work, right? So how could we define acceleration and really measure it? And my claim is we can do this along. We have to distinguish three dimensions. The first, certainly, and this is, of course, something the book pays a lot of attention to, too, and Judy has done a lot writing on this herself, there is technological speed-up. I define this as the intentional speed-up of goal-directed processes, right? So you want to do something faster. You want to spend less time in achieving a certain goal. So this is speeding up of transport. I don't have to give you this is immediately clear, right? I mean, even the bike is a modern thing. I found this very fascinating, right? The bike, it's called vélo in French, quite speakingly, right? Is a modern invention. And I must say, when I try to convince my students in Jena, I always tell them, well, think of there is a kind of alien cameras watching the world, right? For centuries, maybe they have done it, right? They occasionally would see long-term traveling before the 18th century, but it would be very slow. Marco Polo went to China, but it took him years, and then he stayed there for years, and even his father did, but it was isolated cases. Often it was accidental, and certainly it wasn't on a kind of regular and mass base. Right? It's maybe true that the Vikings sailed the Atlantic, or the Polynesians also went to America, but maybe it was by accident, and probably it was only very singular. But from the 18th century onward, and even before, this for me is very important when we think about technology. The speeding up of the world starts before we have new technologies. They really tried to, for example, they reconstructed the roads. They tried, you know, very often the roads were kind of along the streaks and the small rivers, so they went like this. And then all of a sudden, in the 17th, 18th century, they wanted to make them straight because it would save them time. And you see it with the traveling in horse carts, right? The pre-modern way, I know it's dangerous to talk about pre-modern world, but the pre-18th century way of traveling was that you had horses before the cart, for example, and when they were tired, you had to wait for 7 or 8 hours, and then you would continue your journey. And then, of course, they discovered that it would be much faster if they just exchanged the horses before the cart. Then you can continually travel. So there were really attempts to speed up traveling, also sailing and communication. And I'm convinced that the steam engine and this the revolutions, the transport revolution Paul Virilio writes about, is already an answer to a changed perception of temporality. When temporality became a scarce thing, the steam engine came along, and even the Industrial Revolution. Louis Mumford says, well, the key engine of the Industrial Revolution is not the steam engine, but the clock. It was the idea to speed up productions. So the first realm, and my story is about the 18th century with the alien cameras, right? After the 18th century, I mean, there would be with the steam ships, right? There would be regular, slowly increasing in terms of mass, a sailing of the oceans. But of course, then there comes the railway. First, only Manchester, Liverpool, I believe, and it was very slow. But then it became faster, and the network increased. And these cameras would see, oh, something is going on down there, right? There is more and more traffic, right? It's getting long distance in India and in Northern America. And it's an increase in the volume of people and of goods and of raw materials who are traveling. And then there is the velo starts, right? There is an increase in the speed of what people do in the cities where they live. And then there comes the tram and the subway and so on. And then there comes the car. Just think of the kinetic energy or the kinetic state of the world. It's incredibly increasing all the time. And while we sit and speak here, there are about 1.5 million people up in the air right now. So the camera really has a very spectacular view. What are they doing down there, right? They are setting the world literally in motion. And if they have very good cameras, which they certainly have, they will also... They will also see that there is an incredible increase in the speed of capital that's circulating and ideas and communication flows and so on. So I think very literally we set the world in motion. So the first realm is technological acceleration. It's the speeding up of transport, of communication, but also of production. Right? So sometimes the speeding up of production is forgotten, but all through, of course, this is related to capitalism. The necessity to speed up the production of goods and to some extent also of services is very crucial for this. But when Goethe, for example, complains about the velociferous, the devilish, the Luciferian character of our age, he actually did not have so much in mind technology. He has some references to technology and even to the railways. But basically, he noticed that the world changes. It does not stay the same. So the second dimension of acceleration, I call it the acceleration of social change, means that the rates of change seem to increase. Right? If, for example, I mean, I think you probably see this most easily when you think of practices and the tools you need to do practices, and also on the patterns of association. They change more and more quickly, right? For centuries, people do always the same things, and they do it the same way. But now when I come back to London, right after, I don't know how many years, 20 or 30 years or so, kind of everything has changed. The shops are not where they used to be, right? The telephones, the public phones have gone and so on. And I mean, there's a million of changes in the way things are done, but also in where things are and what they mean. So the patterns of association change at an increasing rate, and the forms of practice change at an increasing rate, and the rates of and the decay rates of knowledge increase. This is a very controversial claim, but I think you can uphold it. I mean, it's knowledge about the world, for example, about who works where or who lives where or who has what cell phone number or what phone number, for example, and in many ways. I mean, it takes some time to really establish this very empirically, very strongly. But the definition I try to give here is that there is, with a German philosopher, Hermann Lübbe, but you can also get it through Luhmann, it's the idea that there is a contraction of the present, so to speak, right? The period of stability where you know how the world works and where who is where and how one does things is contracting. The tomorrow's world, so to speak, gets closer and closer to the present. So there are increasing decay rates of practices, of patterns of association, and of knowledge. It's very important to see that this is distinct. There's an acceleration of the pace of life. Nigel Dodd has already referred to it, and that it has two sides actually, an objective and a subjective side. Subjectively, and that's very mysterious. That's how I started to think about it. Subjectively, it's the impression that we are running out of time. It's really strange. The history of modernity is not just the history of accelerating things, speeding them up. It's also the history of time shortage, right? Through the decades, people have increasingly the perception that time gets a short commodity. They are running out of time. They have to run faster and faster just to keep their place in the world, right? On the subjective side, it's the impression, the notion that time becomes scarce. Robinson and Godby say it will be the scarcest resources of the 21st century. Not oil. You can replace oil with other things. You can substitute for oil, but not for time. On the objective side, I think we can define an increase in the pace of life as an increase in the number of episodes of action per unit of time. That would mean, I claim, since you live in the modern age, right? I call it late modern age for reasons I don't talk about this today, because I think there are kind of cultural changes within this history of acceleration. But since you live in a modern age, you try to speed up your life by trying to get more episodes of action done per day, per week, per year, and even in your lifetime. And it's episodes of action or of experience, and we do them by trying to act at a faster pace, fast food, right? I mean, we know that people, they love to watch all these broadcasts about how you cook your meal yourself, but in fact, people don't take the time to cook. I mean, it's really decreasing permanently, so they go for fast food, for speed dating, for power naps instead of a real siesta, for quality time with their kids, for there are hundreds of technologies, even drive-through funerals, apparently. there is one small community who really invented that. So you can speed up the number of episodes of action per unit of time by acting faster or by getting rid of pauses and intervals. So you take the last subway train, which brings you to the LSE, and you try not to waste time on your way here. And you try multitasking, right? So while you sit and listen to the boring talk, you can do some emailing or do something else. And it's very interesting, using the telephoning, talking on the phone was a monotasking activity for many decades. Right? Now you feel if you only talk on the phone that you waste your time, right? You should do some surfing in between or do some, I don't know, there are many ways of what you can do. So we try to increase the number of episodes of action per unit of time. So these are three distinct dimensions of social acceleration. Now the question is, what is driving this? And in my acceleration book, I arrived. I mean, I have four answers. No, I have. I call them motors. I identify four motors which explain why this logic of speeding up the world in these three dimensions is a kind of a never ceasing. So one is that it has become a kind of self-propelling system, because technological acceleration is driving social change. The introduction of faster technology is not just reducing the time we need for things, it's also changing our world. The car, for example, has changed many practices and even the urban landscape and so on. And the internet, of course, computers and internet, they have changed the way we work, the way we communicate, the way we play, the way we entertain ourselves, the way we inform ourselves. So technological acceleration certainly is one driving factor for the acceleration of social change. And it's the perception that the world is speeding up, right? So it's, the world changes at a higher pace. So we have to run faster and faster to keep pace with the world, right? So the, if you think, if you feel that the world is becoming faster, you need to speed up yourself, because otherwise you are no longer up to date with your hardware, with your software, with your emailing, with your friends, with the news, and with many other things, right? So I really believe that our everyday perception is that we are falling behind. We are standing like on downward escalators. I find this a very useful image, right? For example, while you sit here, you kind of stand on downward escalators with your email system, right? Every 20 minutes or 10 or 5, I don't know, in email or WhatsApp, some message is getting in and you're falling behind. So when you finish and you turn on, you have to run an ever higher a staircase, right, in order to be up to date. But the thing is, you stand on many, many escalators. So, for example, I always buy the newest, fastest, hottest computer, and when I set it up at home, it already says you're falling. Your virus protection is not up to date. Your Adobe Reader is not up to date, right? And it's this kind of thing in all aspects of life. So we have the feeling we have to run faster and faster and more escalators just to stay in place. So the acceleration of social change creates the feeling that time is a scarce commodity. And if that's the case, we want faster technologies. Since I feel I'm running out of time, my computer shouldn't waste my time by being slow, or the train should go as fast as possible and so on. So the first answer to what is driving this is it has become a self-propelling system. But there are three external motors driving the logic. One is capitalism, right? I don't have the time to go into this. Maybe certainly Nigel has something to say about has a lot of things to say about the equation time is money in a capitalist society. It's actually quite tricky when you look at it why this is so. But as we know from Benjamin Franklin, in a capitalist society, if you save time, right, you reduce labor costs, for example, but also you have the chance to make extra profits. And in a credit system, of course, you're always well advised to try to pay it back as fast as possible. So there's a number of reasons why you have to be fast in a capitalist society, but I believe maybe the main motor is the logic of competition, not only in the economy. It's the logic of competition everywhere, because in competition, you know, the yardstick is achievement, and achievement is the yardstick is achievement per time, right? So being faster means being ahead in a competitive system. So the logic of competition certainly is a driving motor, and also functional differentiation itself, this logic of, you could even call it the division of labor and take it to that level, because it increases the number of escalators on which you stand. It's theoretically not too easy to prove that point, but you can do it easily relatively easily with Luhmann. I don't want to go into it here. I just want to point out that we are not just the victims of the speed logic. I said this in the beginning with the Motorhead, right, with the Orgasmatron. I believe with German philosopher Blumenberg or Friedel or Marianne Gronemeyer, that there is a kind of promise in acceleration, and it actually has both sides. It has two sides. It's very attractive, right? It is tied to our notion of freedom and of happiness. One needs to see this. Otherwise, it gets a very distorted picture to say, oh, we poor moderns, we have to speed up every time. But it is tied to our conception of being free, and Blumenberg says it has become, so to speak, our answer to the problem of finitude and death. And this is very interesting. The claim is this. The problem with death is that it always comes too early before you have done everything, right? Before you have completed the world in all its possibilities and your own the possibilities which are in you, within you. So in modern society, Blumenberg and Grönemeyer say the conception of the good life is the idea that you want to have to have a fulfilled life, right? To have the options of the world, its possibilities, its experiences, really you want to live them. And you want to unfold the possibilities, the capacities which are in you. And of course, death comes too early for this. The world time, he says, is always longer than your individual lifetime. But if you speed up your life, if you double the speed, you can have kind of two lives within one, right? You can have the number of experiences and the options and the things you do. You can double them if you live twice as fast. You can have two lives within one. And if you become indefinitely fast, you can have an eternal life before death. And interestingly, that's maybe how we think about death, right? Okay, we all know one day we have to die. Some of you might believe that then there something comes after it, some don't. But nevertheless, the emphasis is on life before death. And actually, they say, yes, I know one day I have to die, but before that, there are so many things I want to do, places I want to visit, people I want to meet, and so on. So probably it's true. I mean, and then also Egon Friedel writes about this. There is some element also of panic in this, right? Running away from finitude and death. Of course, you get that argument with Heidegger too. I have 15 more minutes, I believe. Yes, I can do. Oh yeah, this is the Social Acceleration book, which I wrote on this. Oh yeah, and now here comes. Okay, I'll give you the main argument now very quickly. Then I looked at of course not everything is speeding up, right? I've set out three dimensions of acceleration so fast, but then I realized I had to kind of give the counter story. What is not speeding up? And there are at least five different dimensions or things which are not speeding up. I mean, there are some natural or anthropological limits, right? For example, a day has 24 hours because it's the time the Earth takes to revolve around itself. It's very hard to speed that up. I mean, we somehow try to manipulate it and make chicken think the day has only 23 hours. We do that by artificial light, so they produce more eggs, but nevertheless, there are natural limits in our bodies also, for example, right? Or in the speed with which we can produce oil. Then there are some things which could speed up, but it just never happened. It did not happen so far. That can be cultural. Some practices with the Amish, for example, you know, this religious sect, they still travel by horse carts, for example, because they refuse modern technology. So that could be speeded up, but they don't do it. They are territorial, so there are some areas in the Nicomares, in Andabares, or in the Amazonas, which has not been touched by this logic of speeding up. And there might also be segmental pockets of deceleration. Some say university administrations are kind of pockets for this. I mean, there's always a kind of pressure on these, right, to speed up. Then there are, which is maybe the most interesting thing, is sometimes things actually slow down because everyone wants to be fast. The traffic jam is the classic example for this, right? I was shocked at first when someone said, well, you, Mr. Acceleration Guy, are you aware of the fact that the average speed in London is going down and not up? At least it has been going down for decades. And I thought, okay, problem. But of course, it's not really a problem, right? I mean, it's an unintended side effect, so to speak. Everyone wants to be fast, and that for some time slows it down. And economic recessions, and I believe even psychological burnouts might be examples of this. And you also find it in politics. Then we have sometimes intentional deceleration. There are some things in your life where you intentionally want to slow down. So of course, for those, I mean, over the weekends, or I mean, there are many forms, or in the evening you take a 20 minutes break, or also you say on Sunday I cook and I want to take the whole day, right? So intentional deceleration, and it comes in two forms. Sometimes, for example, when you practice yoga in the evening at the end of the day, a very popular coping strategy with speed, I believe. There you want to slow down in order to keep up the high pace of life outside the yoga practice, right? And we find this sometimes in politics too. They have a kind of memorandum. Let's kind of take our time here to find a good solution in order to keep the speed game elsewhere going. So that's functional deceleration. It's actually conducive to this high speed of life around it. Then there are sometimes ideological oppositions. When you read through the slow literature, there are, of course, kind of anti-modernist movements where they try to slow things down, and that's then almost a kind of opposition to the modernity and the logic of speed. And maybe most interestingly is in our perception, I will say in 5 minutes something more about this, in our perception there is a kind of flip side, which you actually find in the discourse of modernity also, in L'ennui, for example, right, existential boredom, that you find, well, that nothing really changes. It's a kind of high pace of superficial changes, right? It's the return of the ever same. We are totally frozen. We are not really moving, right? Yes, shops change all the time, and fashions change all the time, and the media change all the time. But in fact, there's a very deep, maybe it's even the end of history. And actually, I spent a lot of time on this, and I find it very interesting, but I don't have the time. So one very important finding is, now this is very important. I claim we live in acceleration society because when you look at these five dimensions of deceleration, they are not really motors themselves. As I say here, they are either residual, they are kind of left over, or they are reactions to speed. But they are not on the same level as the speeding up, that's the forces of acceleration, which I pointed up first. So I believe there's an asymmetry between the power, the force that speeds up the world, and the slowdown factors. So this is the first point I wanted to make. Now I'm really running out of time, and that's why I want to go straight here. I'm sorry for this. But this is very, so that, because there is a second argument which I find very important. Why can we speak of acceleration society? Well, what is really strange is the fact, well, maybe I go back one more. This is very interesting, right? If you think of, I mean, why do we have the feeling that we are running out of time when we are so efficient in saving time? I mean, this is really a great paradox, right? As you see here, I quote the Life magazine from the 21st February 1964. It said, the title was, "The Time Problem Ahead." And the claim was, well, actually, modern society is running into a huge problem. People don't know what to do with their time. They will feel incredibly bored, right, because technology speeds up. And so what do we do with the time we save? Now, this is not your existential situation. You feel you're short on time. So why is it? Look at the graph I'm giving here. I mean, this is the total amount of time which you need through history. You can say here 1800 and here to the 21st century. The total amount of time you would need for a given number of tasks. Let's say in a day, what do you have to do? You have to travel 6 kilometers. You have to copy a book. And you have to answer 3 letters or messages or so, right? So this would take you, because to copy a book would actually mean you have to handwrite it, so it would probably take you 8 hours or so. And traveling 6 kilometers would take you at least 1 hour, and writing 3 letters would take you some time. But the time you need for traveling reduces, and certainly the time you need to multiply a book reduces. You would when I was at the LSE, I had to photocopy it, right? Each single page, so it still takes you kind of an hour if it's a 300-page book. Now you just download it, right? And writing an email only takes half the time of writing a letter. So the total amount of time you need is really only a fraction of what it would have taken you in 1800. So what happens with the rest of the time? I mean, that's the mysterious thing. And there's only one plausible answer to this. And that's this. Right, the growth rates, there is a certain escalatory tendency which is driving it. I mean the answer is really easy. I mean, the problem is, if you traveled 6 kilometers in 1800, you now probably travel 40 kilometers or 50 kilometers. If your task is, your professional job is copy one book in 1800, you probably have to copy 500 books now if you download it or so, right? And with email, you see it very obviously. You see it in your own life. Of course, writing a letter writing an email is twice as fast than writing a letter, right? So you save half the time. But if you write and read 4 emails when you only wrote 2 letters before, then it takes you the same amount of time. But if you increase the number of messages you read and write by the factor of, let's say, 5, but you only double the speed, then, of course, you create the feeling that there's a shortage of time. So with almost all technologies, you really see that the rates of increase are higher than the rates of acceleration. You can, for example, we save time by changing our, by washing the clothes, right? It takes the machine, it takes long, but it doesn't take us long to do the washing, the laundry. But of course, so we save a lot of time, but now we change the underwear every day or so, right? So you're even there, you see that the growth rate is as high or sometimes higher than the acceleration rate. And with email, you see what happens then. You feel permanently pressed. I mean, okay, I'm sorry, you don't do emails anymore. That's a part of the acceleration of social change. After email, it was Facebook or so. Now Facebook is out too. Then it was WhatsApp, and now it's Snapchat or so. You can do it with pictures. But if you still write messages, you have the feeling you're permanently overwhelmed, so you leave away the greetings and so on. You try to speed it up. So I would say an acceleration society is this society where the growth rate, the rate of increase, is above the acceleration rate. So you have both. You feel you're running out of time, even though you have a technological acceleration. So the next problem I have to solve, as I said, now I will be short. This is now the second part. No, we are already in the middle of the second part, which is good. How do we explain this? What does modernity lead to the stage two, where growth rates are higher than acceleration rate? Here is my explanation. I really believe you only understand modern society when you understand that its mode of stabilization, you could actually say its mode of structural reproduction, is dynamic, which means, here's the definition, a society is modern when it shifts to a mode of dynamic stabilization. That means it systematically requires growth, increase, and innovation, and that means acceleration, because I define acceleration as a quantitative increase per unit of time for its structural reproduction. It's easy to see what this means when you look at the economy. In a capitalist economy, needs to grow in order to keep its structure. Right. I mean, now we can actually, it would take another hour to really discuss this thoroughly. But basically, I really claim in a capitalist economy, I mean, it follows this logic here. Money, commodity, money, prime. I don't have to tell students at the LSE or colleagues at the LSE what this means. It's money, commodity, more money. The logic is the structure of the economy can only be maintained. And by the way, and through this also the structure of society, through permanent increase. Right, and it's an increase. Somehow, it's an increase first of money or of value. You somehow have to produce that, and it's very often done through speeding up and through innovation. But I think it's not only capitalism which follows this logic. My favorite other field is science. What we are doing here, right? We are not trying to preserve knowledge and hand it down from one generation to the next, which is the case for most culture, for most societies we know. The scholar, the school, it's called London School of Economics, right? The idea of the school is that the wise teachers give their knowledge to the students and they preserve it as a treasure from one generation to the next. But in modernity, science, in German, Wissenschaft, you hear it in this Schaft word, right? It's making new knowledge. It's what Weber says. Science does not live from the idea that we hand down knowledge, but it's the idea that we increase knowledge. We go beyond what we've known before. So you see here, it's knowledge, research, more knowledge. Without the promise that we go beyond, that we increase, that we dynamize, so to speak, science cannot live, and it's the same in the arts. It's no longer mimetic art, it's the idea of originality, innovation, of going beyond, and it's the same in politics and law too. So the idea is that what is the core of modernity is that it can only stabilize itself, maintain the institutional structures, which means you cannot have a welfare state, you cannot have a capitalist market, you cannot have our science system, you cannot even have our art system without permanent increase. And the logic of increase and the logic of acceleration are conceptually intertwined. So this is now said. So finally, why is this a problem? This is my last point, right? Well, I believe it's a problem because not all spheres of life, now what I said you saw with the camera, modernization is, through the logic of dynamic stabilization, setting the world in motion, materially, socially, individually, even spiritually, if you so like. But not all spheres of life can be accelerated to the same extent. Not everything is speedable to the same extent. I actually think it's quite interesting if you take sociology at the kind of literal level, that you see with the different, I mean, capital has been, Sigmund Baumann, who unfortunately just died, right, he has made that argument quite forcefully, right? Capital could speed up in the financial markets even to the speed of light, but work, labor could not, right? So there's a kind of desynchronization between that, but you can also see it, the social, the inequality has something to do with this. The jet set elites, scientific, but certainly more so economic or in the entertainment, in all the elites have become very flexible, fast moving, going everywhere. So the fast win out and the slow lose out. But I believe the four major crises of our modern age, and that's my last slide, I promise, can be explained as crises of desynchronization. There are things that cannot be speeded up and they are in danger of being destroyed or eroded or lost. So I think the ecological crisis, which certainly is a crisis of our late modern age at least, clearly is a crisis of desynchronization. The pace of social and technological processes is too high for the natural reproduction of resources and for the disposal of waste, right? We cut down trees at a pace which is too high. We fish the oceans at a pace which is too high for their reproduction. And we emit pollution which is at a pace which is too high for nature to deal with it. Then I believe, which I find very interesting, the current crisis of democracy, and I don't think there's any doubt left that there is a problem in democracy. And I believe it has something to do with the speed, with the proper speed of democracy itself and of the media and the economy, for example, because democracy, you cannot really speed up. I mean, if you think democracy is just about taking votes, then you can speed it up almost to the speed of light. But if you really take the democratic discourse serious, then it has something to do with articulating positions, right? And then entering into a deliberative dialogue, sorting out the force of arguments, right? And reaching something like a consensus, which actually transforms people involved. I call it now a process of resonance, where you listen to the other positions and you try to answer the other positions. And this is exactly what is lost. We don't listen to it. You only have kind of echo chambers, right? Both sides only hear idiots on the other side. So, but what I want to say is that democracy in a high-speed age actually needs to slow down, because if it becomes more pluralistic, there are more positions which need to be formulated and heard. And if the decisions become more complex, it takes longer time to really do the process of deliberation if you want to keep the same level of rationality. So democracy has a kind of almost inherent tendency to slow down under late modern conditions. But this time is not left. I mean, you saw it with the Euro crisis, for example. It always, or with the Lehman crisis and all the other things, they always said the markets need answers, right? And the media, the logic of the media, of course, also forces politicians to react quickly. So I think there's desynchronization between fast socioeconomic life and slow democracy. Mm-hmm. And even in the economy, I think this would be something to discuss also. I believe there is a serious desynchronization between the speed of financial markets, because there you can speed it up. I mean, sometimes it's computer algorithms which trade, right? So this you can do it with the speed of light. But the production of real goods and commodities and also services is time-consuming, and also the consumption of goods is time-consuming. If you want to consume a book, in my view, I have a chapter on the difference between buying and consuming. In my view, it's a kind of a strange confusion that we always think it's the same. You did not consume the book when you buy it. You only consume it when you read it. And that's time-consuming, right? And actually, all the things are time. You can buy a huge piano, right, within fractions of seconds. But if you want to really consume a piano, would mean that you are capable of playing it, and that takes ages. So I believe there is a kind of desynchronization between the financial markets and the real economy. And for me, one of the most interesting things is whether you can claim that there's something like a psycho crisis, right? In our cultural reproduction and in our individual reproduction, there might be speed limits too, right? And of course, Ehrenberg has started this discussion by saying that maybe burnout is the kind of reaction. And not only by those who suffer burnout, but that we are culturally have become so sensitive to this problem, right? The psycho crisis, that we might burn out. That might have something to do with a desynchronization between our psychic speed limits and maybe even our bodily speed limits and the speed of socioeconomic lives. So you see, there's a whole number of problems involved with this logic of acceleration society. And this is what I wanted to tell you. Thanks a lot.
an absolutely wonderful talk. I'm going to be very brief. I just want to personally say how delighted I am that Harmit came for this public lecture, because I can't think of anyone better to be here when we're launching this book, The Sociology of Speed. And in many ways, you know, my response, you know, I was asked to sort of give a response. My response is the book, actually. The response has been, you know, the book has been, in a way, yes, thank you, yes, Nigel's holding it up, you know, precisely to our thinking for many years about the social relations of time. And I've thought a lot about this. I've done a lot of empirical research, particularly on technologies, digital technologies, mobile phones, all how these new technologies are affecting our sense of temporality. And really, it was only when I came across Hartmut's sort of theoretical work that it somehow crystallised a lot of these themes for me. And I think we could really say that in the last 10 years or so, acceleration and speed and the sociology of time, and I know there's been a journal for longer than a decade, I don't know if it's two decades, or, but it seems to me that this is more and more becoming central to social theory, to sociology, that the there's a huge amount of interest in these things, and that's why Nigel and I organised this conference, which we had at the LSE, as Nigel said, 18 months ago. And we had the good fortune of literally sort of inviting the people that we thought were doing the most interesting work in this area, and they all said they would come. So we had a fantastic couple of days. And so I just want to literally, for a few moments, tell you about the structure of the book. I mean, it's basically in three sections. The first section we call Theories, and it looks at contemporary and historical theories about time. We then have a section on materialities, where we try and focus on, you know, the technical infrastructure and institutional infrastructure, if you like, that underpins our speed. And the third section is actually looking much more at the everyday experience of temporality and how it's multiple and distinctive. And there's lots of splendid authors represented, and some of them you will know well, like Hartmut here, Saskia Sassen, Harvey Moloch, John Urry, and some terrific younger scholars who you probably aren't aware of because they work in different fields, like Steve Jackson, Sarah Sharma, and Melissa Gregg. And actually, one of the main things we tried to do at the conference and succeeded in bringing together in the book was to really show that actually it's at the intersection of lots of different disciplines that the interesting work's going on. And by this I mean social and cultural theory, science and technology studies, information systems, what's now called software studies, organisation studies, and media studies. And I like to think that what's unique about the book is that we've brought together people from the different disciplines in a very sort of fruitful and engaging way. And one theme that emerges very strongly in the book, and of course it's a theme dear to you know, my own work, is that is how a sort of socio-technical or socio-material, if you like, conception of time and speed gives us new perspectives on these questions. And if I can just mention sort of very quickly just a couple of examples. I mean, the book ends with a piece by Steve Jackson, who works in information systems, who's written very eloquently about the repair work and maintenance work that actually underlies a lot of these speeds, that actually in a lot of this discourse of speed, we forget about all the digital labour, all the breakdowns, all the kind of everyday technical and institutional work that goes on in order to sort of produce this speed. I mean, similarly, Donald McKenzie talks very much about the materiality of high-speed trading, and that it's talked about as if it's ethereal and in the cloud and somewhere else, but actually he describes in great detail the material infrastructure this needs. Saskia does this in terms of the city. And Sarah Sharma has a very nice piece in the book where she talks about, and actually we've got some photos of the inside of taxi cabs, you know, taxi drivers' cabs. And she sort of talks very eloquently about how they live in these cabs and that they spend a lot of time waiting to facilitate the speed of the rich. And she's very good in her piece at talking about the inequalities in terms of who's fast and who's slow and who's privileged, and the way in which the dynamics of power are really sort of infused in this discussion. And that theme really goes through the whole book. As I said, my sense is that this topic is continuing to be a hot topic. I have to say that whenever I open the newspaper, there's another article advising me on how to optimise my time, particularly around Christmas, for some before Christmas, after Christmas, loads of apps for productivity. I mean, I must say I've sort of introduced a topic this year for the first time in one of my courses on self-tracking apps, which I thought was a very trivial, I have to say, topic. But actually, you know, I've been reading about self-tracking technologies, and a colleague of mine who's written a book on it, Gina Neff in Oxford, is going to come and talk to my master's students about it. And it seems to me there's a lot that we can say about self-tracking and optimization, that these are all sort of great new topics. Yeah. Actually, I don't even think I'll ask a question because there's so little time. If no one else has,
We're running out of time.
But I just thought there's probably loads of questions, so let's give it over to them.
Yeah? Thanks very much, Judy.
Thank you.
Okay, I saw a hand here, so I think we've got a mic, so wait, otherwise we won't.
Hi. Thank you for taking the time and coming. So I unfortunately didn't have the time to read all of your writings yet, so I have a question. Maybe you've already written on it and you can direct me there. Otherwise, I'd like your thoughts on that. The notion of attention and maybe the attention economy in the writings of Frank or Georg Münch. How exactly does that tie in? You were mentioning the anthropological limitations, so 24 hours and every second, but every second is also, of course, a moment of attention we can spend, and there's only so much we can do in the end. And how does that tie in with acceleration, but also especially, as you said, with resonance, because now we have so much like to choose from, but also we don't have the time to actually reflect on it, but still we're forced to consume more and more.
This is a very important question. I mean, it's the economy of attention, right? It's very important, and it's closely tied up with the speed stuff, really. I mean, the one thing when I talked about simul, right? There's an increase in the number of stimulations, so it becomes kind of. There are many competitors which ask for our attention, but it's not just an external thing. It's also an internal thing that all the time we think there are many things which we would be possibly interested in and to direct our attention to. So empirically, you find a huge fragmentation of attention, right? I mean, the attention spans are greatly reduced, which has something to do also with modern technologies. And as you said, quite rightly, I got very interested in my new book. It's called Resonance, and the subtitle is on a self-world relationship. It's a bit different in German. I don't really know how to do it very well in English. But the thing is, if you're short on time, then attention becomes very focused and very one way. And actually you lose the capacity for resonance, because a resonating relationship is that you get into contact with something which has a number of kind of, has a very elusive character. You don't know what happens. You might be transformed in a way you don't know before. I think the best way to think about it is that there are two forms of reading. Actually, I'm a very slow reader, I always found, and now I think that's quite good, right? Because if you read slowly, your mind wanders around and you don't really know what the result is. And then there are many technologies of speed reading, very focused, right? Very attentive, so you get the information, but you kind of almost block being touched by something, right? You don't want to be touched, you want to be efficient and focused. And my claim is that if you have to be fast, you develop a kind of instrumental stance towards the world. I call it a kind of mute relationship, which makes you very efficient. And it doesn't mean that you're not attentive, right? But the quality of attention changes, because it becomes directed and intentional. And it becomes very difficult then to get into a mode of resonance, because resonance is a state of relating to some person or something, like a book, or it could be a piece of music or so, which affects you. You let yourself be affected, which actually means you are also vulnerable. And you never know when it happens and what the outcome of it is and how long it takes. So if attention needs to be very focused and very instrumental, the quality of attention changes from a resonant towards a mute form of relating.
Judy?
Can I just add a point You know, just to support what you're saying, there's a terrific book by Tim Wu, I don't know if that's the one you mean, called The Attention Economy. Yeah. And he writes very eloquently about how social media is endlessly designed and perfected to capture our attention, and this is the way these companies make money.
Yeah, of course.
And it's like sort of internet gambling, that, you know, the best psychological academics are being employed by these companies to absolutely maximize,
and
they're terribly good at it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, people are competing for my attention. Sorry. There was a question there. Further back.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you. Sorry. Yes. With the glasses. Yes. Yeah. There's a mic. Yeah.
Yeah, I think my question also refers to the last point where you were mentioning the study, how long the taxi drivers wait. Because what I've noticed in the talk is that you've pretty much focused on the people for whom time accelerates. But you could also argue that there is always the other side of the story, because with time accelerating for some people, also especially with like in a capitalist system, you have like rising youth unemployment. Mm. And I guess also a lot of people here, they have friends on WhatsApp, they have a lot of time. Mm. And then it also comes to maybe the question, whose time matters more? Whose time matters? Mm.
Yeah.
And whose time is always available that you can claim in a way? But what I think is interesting is, especially when you speak about the crisis, also your analysis of like a democratic crisis. Mm. I'm not so sure if it covers the whole picture of time, because you could also argue that a democracy goes into crisis if a lot of people feel that their time has no relevance in the system.
Yeah.
So I was just like wanting to highlight that, and also maybe what you think about it, if I got it wrong or if there's any other explanation.
No, I mean, you certainly didn't get it. You didn't get it wrong, but nevertheless, I mean, that's actually a problem I had to struggle a lot with, because at first, when I came up with this topic, a lot of people said, well, that's a typical problem for academics, right? But it's not a problem for most other people. And I would really want to turn it around. I would really claim, I mean, you didn't say that, right? I think your point was very right there. But I really claim, well, those who say this have no idea of empirical reality, because it's in all segments of the economy. I mean, just join a day with a truck driver, for example, right? It's incredible. At a construction site, or other people working in the bakeries or so, right, who have to serve many clients or so, and certainly in everything that has to do with the care economy, right, in hospitals and so on. So I think there is a difference in the way temporal pressure is experienced, because with the elites, it's kind of internalized, it's kind of habitualized, right? We permanently feel we should be fast, because you could say our time is valuable, right? And with other strata of society, it's basically external pressure, right? Other people tell you have to be fast, which is certainly very bad too. But time sovereignty does not solve the problem per se, right? Because I actually could make your condition much worse if I tell you have to be very fast between 8 and 5, then at least you have a certain chance that after 5, you kind of can take away. If I say, well, you can do it whenever you want, but the amount of things you have to do is permanently increases according to the logic of increase, then your world gets even more miserable. So nevertheless, I think it's in all segments of the economy you find temporal pressure increasing. And then you're quite right, you find maybe also increasing in southern Europe, certainly increasing segment or group of people who are kind of, I call them forcefully decelerated, so to speak, because they are, as you said, they are unemployed, or they might be sick or so, or sometimes old age pensioners. They are cut off from the logic of the allocation game altogether. So as you say, their time is kind of completely devalued, right? But the problem is actually they are culturally and structurally made to feel that they should catch up, which becomes more and more impossible, right? The longer you are kind of already ghettoized or cut off from the logic of the speed game, the more you're left out. But basically you could say all three groups are affected by the logic of acceleration, and they are affected affected in a sense of being kind of desynchronized, right, in bad ways. So I don't think speed is only a problem for the rich. Speed and this logic of speed affects social strata, but it affects them in different ways. So basically that would be the answer.
Mm-hmm. The back there, yeah.
Thank you. sorry, I'm interested to know what your thoughts are on accelerationism and the relationship with the development of political subjectivity. Because what comes to my mind is, particularly with the frenetic pace of the news consumption, if you look back at the year, for example, all you see are...
Edward?
When you look back at the year, for example, all you see is, to my mind, a sort of graph of different emotional states, so to speak. It's a constant feed of news. It's a picture of a crowd sat in front of the television responding in a variety of emotional ways. Ooh, ah, oh. And that's how it feels, effectively.
Yeah.
And in terms of the developmental of political subjectivity, it seems so frenetic. There's the development of, in a Herbert Marcusean way, a rent-a-crowd militancy, where there's a lack of real political engagement with issues. And what it renders political issues is an emotive response, a sort of moralizing as opposed to a real grappling with substantial issues.
Yeah.
In a way, it's a lack of real political subjectivity with emancipatory potentials.
Yeah, thank you very much for this question, which I find very important too. I mean, political issues are something which are very important from my point of view, and that's maybe also, of course, a realm where things are changing a lot. And to my own understanding, the way I'm trying to get at it, I really have to introduce the notion of alienation. Actually, I find Marcuse very, very interesting there too. I would agree with you. It looks like what Simmel actually said. You know, he was talking about the blasé attitude, which meant that because of there are so many stimulations, right? People kind of develop a kind of blasé attitude, saying that basically we call it now staying cool, right? Whatever happens, I stay totally cool, right? There's a spectacular accident or so. Yeah, when is my train leaving or so? And and he says, so you need stronger and stronger stimulations to feel anything at all. And I think somehow this seems to be true when we watch the news, right? So, okay, there's another bomb attack. So, yeah, so what's the news, basically? But my take is really, you know, in the resonance book, I try to develop it. The way we relate to things changes, and I believe democracy works as a sphere of resonance. And I would call then only then we are real political subjects, also in the sense of Hannah Arendt. It means that you feel connected with the other people in two ways. First, what happens out there I'm meant by it, I'm addressed by it, and I feel self-efficacy. Right, it's the concept by Bandura, self-efficacy. I was reflecting a lot about it's because it's what you say. There's a kind of and O, but it's also kind of disaffection, right? I mean, there are many horrible things going on, and we kind of feel kind of hopeless, right? And I think this has to do because we don't have the feeling of self-efficacy, that we are really addressed by things that happen, and that we feel political subjects who really can do something. So I believe things like the Brexit, for example, or even the Trumpists, and I would say the whole right-wing populist movements or the populist movements, their starting point is a quite right observation, namely alienation. They have the feeling what's going on in the political sphere, in the world of news, has nothing to do with me, right? I'm not meant, I'm not heard. That's what they always say, the populists, right? We feel we are forgotten by politicians, right? The whole Trump voter said, well, now finally we are heard and seen again. So that's what I mean by resonance. I'm heard, I'm seen, I can make my voice heard, and that's and on the other hand, it's I feel that I'm a political subject. I mean, the Brexit supporters, they said, take back control. It shouldn't be Brussels. It shouldn't be the World Trade Organization or some globalization mechanisms which are defining and shaping your world. The idea is that it's us as political subjects who shape the world. The problem with the right-wing populists is actually that they kind of they lose resonance on both ends. They don't want to hear the others. They want to build walls. I think it's not accident that the guiding image is the wall, the fence, right? The world is perceived as a kind of dangerous fear, uncontrollable, alienated. So they want to build walls and fences and things like that and borders. While in fact, what they should try to get at is recreating the political sphere as a sphere of resonance, where you redevelop an attitude of listening and answering, right? This process of being affected by what the other says, but having the conviction that what you do and your voice is heard and brought into the kind of democratic concert too, because that opens the chance of changing yourself and changing the others and re-changing the world. So I believe that, as you say, the conditions for political subjectivity are kind of negatively affected by the logic of this permanent speed up in the media system and by the state of globalization generally.
You please, yeah, and then I've got you.
Hello, good evening. What do you recommend us doing in front of such an acceleration of everything? I have the impression that to keep sane, we need to decelerate and to have a self-discipline to remove ourselves maybe from social networks or other things in order to avoid two things. Maybe it's a generalized burnout. Mm.
Yeah,
and also maybe we need to decelerate if you want to think deeply about things, because this acceleration is also leading us to think always in a more superficial way. So what do you recommend us?
So what can we do? I mean, normally I'd say at this point, I don't want to be a coach, right? because I have a problem there. In the German media, I was actually called the guru of deceleration or the pope of deceleration or the prophet of deceleration, whatever. And I always thought, well, like in this talk, I did not recommend deceleration. And actually, I'm very skeptical. I mean, my whole resonance book is a kind of, it was trying to find a way out, right? But I don't think it's deceleration for two reasons. I mean, one is, you know, what I try to get at with the concept of dynamic stabilization, or basically with all what I'm saying, it's the logic of increase with which we reproduce our society and stabilize it. So we cannot leave everything as it is and just slow down. Because, I mean, at least German politicians have exactly this idea. It's amazing. All across the party system, I was approached by leading politicians, also from Switzerland, who said, yeah, Mr. Rosa, yes, we perfectly share your view, right? We need to get growth. We need to do everything we can do for keeping up the innovation rates and so on. But we need to give people more time and slow down, right? So they come up with the idea of temporal politics, right? So let's get the economy to boom and make people and also they say we need more competition. The Greens, for example, they want competition everywhere between the kindergartens and between the professors and everywhere. And then we need to give people more time. And I always say, well, that's impossible, right? I mean, it's not that time is a segment like traffic or so. It's temporality goes through everything. So you cannot just slow down. And the other thing is that I don't think slowness per se is good, right? I wanted to get out of this opposition. Speed is bad, and certainly when reading your stuff, right, you would get the same idea. It's kind of, I would almost say, stupid to think that speed is per se bad and slowness is per se good, because a slow internet connection is bad and a slow fire engine is also bad, right? And a slow roller coaster is deadly because it would fall down. But as you said, right, you had something different in mind. I think those who advocate slowness, they are actually aiming for something different, namely, as you said, for a different way of relating to other people. Of course, when I talk to my students, I wish I had more time to really be able not just to tell them what the reading is or when to get it turned in the paper. I want to really talk to them. And when I read a book, I really want to read and think about it, as you said, right? And so on. So I think we have to think about the relationship towards the world. So now I've kind of replaced, it's not about speed bad, slowness good. It's about resonance, right? Good and alienation bad. So, but certainly it's true that in order to that's what I already said in an answer in one of the previous answers, in order to develop resonant relationships with a book, with a landscape, with other people, certainly some form of temporal stability is involved, right? And you have also some form of temporal openness. I think the main thing about resonance is that it has this moment in German, I call it Unverfügbarkeit. If someone can tell me what the best way to express it in English is, I'm really happy. It's kind of non-disposability. What? Unavailability or so. Yeah, you cannot predict when it happens, and you don't know what the outcome is, right? So you have to have some temporal leeway in order to establish relationships of resonance. And that's why a certain element of deceleration certainly would be useful. But it's not that slowness per se should be the normative good thing.
Well, time is speeding up. We've got one more question.
Thank you very much for your talk. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was especially informative. You mentioned at one point the quote from Hamlet, mm-hmm. The time is out of joint.
Yeah.
It leads me to recall one particularly famous instance of that quote being a central focus in Derrida's Spectres of Marx. And his focus there, of course, is thinking about our relationship to futurity and the past. And I wondered, it struck me as perhaps a lacuna somewhat.
The relationship to what?
Futurity, the future,
and the past.
And it struck me as perhaps a lacuna in your talk that so much of our sense of acceleration, it seems to me, you've spoken about is contingent upon a sense of the present.
Mm.
But I wondered how you might relate it to an idea of the future and how acceleration relates to our idea of history.
No, yeah, I mean, on my talk today, you're completely right, but in my own acceleration book, I have a very long chapter on, you know, I said at one point, I talk about our present age as late modernity, right, and I distinguish this from classical modernity and from early modernity, and that has to do with our conception or perception of history, which in turn, I believe, is related to the speed of social change. Right. I personally like that argument very much. We recently discussed it in Cambridge, but actually people have not taken it up very much. My claim is this: there is a kind of, I said, speeding up has something to do with the contraction of the present, right? And I believe there is a kind of, you know, we talk about our world today, and we think there was a different world in the past, and there will be a different way in the future. And therefore, as my claim is, it depends on how long this our world lasts. There is a stability, how long the stability of the basic cultural and structural fabric of the world, what span that covers. And my claim is that in a early or a pre-modern age, when the grandma talks to the grandchild, right, they would just say, in the world, things are like that. Then in modernity, the world changes at least a generational pace. So the grandma would say, you know, kid, in my world, it was a good idea to go to church every Sunday. In your world, it might be different. So there's a perception. That's what Koselleck says. You get a sense of history moving forward. And I call this a generational pace of change when within the 80 years, which you can communicatively or by memory of those who are present, you can spend, you get the feeling the times they are changing. And in our late modern age, we would no longer say my world. The grandma would not say my world and the grandchild would say my world, but they would say right now it's like this. We don't know what tomorrow will be the case. So our perception of history changes with the pace of the speed of social change. But I think the main problem with this is, so I call it contraction of the present, but I think there are indications that the way we relate the past and the future also changes towards a kind of episodic awareness. This has to do with the perception of news too, right? Yes, there was an episode of a Yugoslavia war, you might remember Kosovo, and there was the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War, and basically there was a war before. We don't even know which war was which and which attack was which. It kind of becomes a very fragmented, blurred image of temporality. And I think that creates a form of alienation from temporality and history itself, because resonance, maybe I'm done in a second. I mean, you know, I mean, there is now this cult of mindfulness, right, you which you know. And they always say mindfulness means living totally in the here and now. And actually, I think that's a speed technology itself, because the fulfilling moments of your life is not when you feel totally cut off from yesterday and from tomorrow, but when you feel connected with it, right? But I mean, we all of you know moments of resonance when you felt that you were really meant and addressed something that deeply touched you. If you have tears in your eyes, it's a good indication of resonance. And in that moment, you're not cut off from the past and from the future, but you feel they are connected. Your interpretation of the present gives you a sense of the future and a sense of where you're coming from. So I really believe the way we are situated towards the past and the future is distorted in a way too. And the answer to all the problems is resonance. And that's the new book.
Thank you very much, Hartmut. Thank you very much indeed.